This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to this special podcast to mark the publication of our mid-year global outlook, which offers key views across public and private markets after a particularly eventful first 6 months of 2025. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by a bumper cast of speakers. On our panel here in London are Sonia Loud, our Global CIO, Rob Martin, Global Head of Investment Strategy and Research Private Markets, and Christopher Jeffrey, Head of Macro Strategy. And joining us from the US are David Barron, Global Head of Index and ETFs, and Anthony Woodside, Head of Multi-Sector Fixed Income and Investment Strategy. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the call.
Hello, Max.
Hi, Max.
Well, with no further ado, Sonia, most asset classes have recovered their poise since the recent volatility spike. What are the longer term implications of that episode for investors? And do you think markets are still vulnerable to further shocks?
Thank you, Max. I liked your introduction when you called it eventful. That might be quite the understatement, and most investors probably would use slightly more drastic terminology to describe what has happened in the first half. But you're absolutely right. When you now look at the market levels, one could get the impression that nothing much has happened. And we're back pretty much at all-time highs across the equity spectrum. We have seen spreads, you know, reacting a little bit. But at the end of the day, we are still at very, very tight levels. The only segment, and I'm sure Chris will touch on this, is global government bonds that have had, again, quite a volatile ride, but where we are definitely seeing greater concerns being reflected. Now, if you consider it's early July, so the first half is behind us, I've just outlined where we are. And of course, the big question is what is going to happen, not only in the second half of 25, but as you rightly pointed out, in the longer term context. And of course, at the end of the day, it is about understanding the implications for growth, inflation, and monetary policy. And this is most important when investors are confronted with these levels of volatility to understand what really the fundamental drivers are. And we have had, for the first time, a flurry of policy measures that indeed will potentially have an impact on growth and inflation in particular. And as you look at the markets where they are, it seems that we take a relatively sanguine view on how tariffs will influence growth and inflation. And we definitely think that this is a risk because it's clear that we're waiting for the 9th of July, which is the end of the pause, and we're still waiting for the EU to engage with the US in order to find a solution to their trade relationship. And we have to assume that this can definitely create volatility. And depending on the outcome, clearly negative implications for growth and inflation. What is important longer term, though, is that what we have seen questioned in the first half of the year is how the US will engage with the world longer term. And I know that's a grand statement, but at the end of the day, we have had an overall US umbrella that has been cultivated for the past 70 years, that has been incredibly important to establish trust, not only in US capital markets, but I would go a step further and say actually in the global capital market. And now the question is whether investors will look at the current episode and either say, you know, surely eventually we will find either a new equilibrium, a new balance, or we will see definitely a reset and say, of course, the US will remain and we should be very realistic that with regards to the depth and liquidity and the size of US capital markets, that there's no real alternative. That's been much debated, and we can come to concentration risk later. But clearly there is the opportunity that investors will reassess their exposure to dollars. And I think it would be quite a shift already if investors said they're not buying more. So you don't even have to sell, but if you're not buying more, that would be quite a shift. Why am I saying this? Because, of course, if we look at budget deficits and fiscal sustainability and rising debt levels, that will matter. Because, of course, the government is dependent on someone to buy a rising net new issuance. And so this is where really the market will focus on a lot. This is why I have mentioned global government bond markets already, because it's, of course, there where we will see that mood mostly reflected. And we have had a taster already that there might be unwillingness to accept that this is a good combination. And I know that we are talking a lot about term premium. I know that there's various definitions and various views on this. At the end of the day, it's supply and demand. If a demand is not there for a specific level of supply or a specific price of that supply, then you might see an adjustment. And I believe that we will see a lot more emphasis on the sustainability of these budget deficits. Why are they so unusual? Because they are at levels around 6.5-7%. Whilst we have full employment. This is the unusual combination because normally you would only expect these deficit levels to occur in moments of economic weakness. So there you can see it is still the same longer-term and short-term context. It's growth, inflation, monetary policy, but you can see that there's more immediate drivers versus longer-term drivers that are more structural. And of course, go back to the long-term standing the United States has had globally and the way they're engaging with the world, which can have profound implications on how investors will look at their exposure and will look at the attractiveness of US capital markets.
Cool. Thank you very much for that overview, Sonia. So to summarize there, so most markets, perhaps with the exception of rates, are relatively relaxed to where they were. There are big long-term questions around asset allocation, the US position in the world, and debt sustainability there too. Well, this is a great point at which to bring Anthony into the call. It's great to have you on the podcast, Anthony. Could you give us an American perspective on the first 6 months of the new administration, especially in light of that context from Sonia just now, and in particular, the quite different approach to international relations?
Sure. Thanks, Max, and great to participate as always. Now, while most investors expected tariffs to play a prominent role in the Trump administration's platform, I would say that the focus and the magnitude that we've seen on it this year have really exceeded expectations. While trade tensions have cooled in recent weeks with the announcement of the pause in reciprocal tariffs and the subsequent consummation of trade deals with the UK, with China, and Vietnam, two things have really become clear. One, the administration is willing to play hardball with trading partners to get more favorable terms, and that includes our allies. Two, deglobalization, which has quietly been going on in the background for several years, has meaningfully accelerated under Trump 2.0. So I guess what I'm saying here is the evolution in international trade has become more uncertain, and we are becoming increasingly convicted in that the universal tariff rate of 10% will serve as a floor in this new regime, whereas some countries would be more exposed to higher reciprocal tariffs, particularly if the administration deems them to be bad actors there. So that's a couple of things, at least on the trading of goods. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't touch on the current dynamics surrounding fiscal and monetary policy here. The departure from status quo also extends to both of these areas as well. With respect to fiscal policy, Sonia already detailed and delineated how we're in an environment where you have high debt and an elevated fiscal deficit, which is atypical at this point of the business cycle where you have a relatively strong economy. And then from a monetary policy perspective, of course, the Trump administration has been very vocal in their desire for rates to be lowered. And we're starting to see increasing questions around the independence of the Fed. So I think that also poses a potential credibility threat here. So in summary, when you think about it and you step back, our view is that policy risk is likely to be higher than investors are accustomed to, and as the administration charts a new course for the U.S. economy. And we do think that it's important for investors to take note and really try to optimize for this new normal.
Okay, thank you for unpacking all of that, Anthony. Let's return to some of the themes you've just covered there. Before we move on, I've just got a quick follow-up question, which is, how is the active fixed income team in Chicago navigating the policy uncertainty that you've just outlined?
Sure. Given that U.S. policy uncertainty is likely to remain elevated for a while, we do think it is imperative for investors to update their playbooks to adjust to this environment. So I guess the question is, how have we tailored our approach? There's a couple of things that we've been particularly focused on. First, we believe it's even more important in today's environment to underwrite the companies in your portfolio focusing on names that have strong balance sheets and that can withstand multiple quarters of elevated volatility and uncertainty. So that's one thing that we're starting with. We're also specifically targeting companies that have pricing power here. So the ability to pass on higher import costs, particularly given that we're going to be in an environment where tariffs are going to be higher than we're accustomed to being in. So you really want to be able to preserve those margins in this environment. So we're orienting towards those type of firms in our book. And then we do think it's important to be more tactical in portfolios and more so than what we traditionally would have been, really focusing on range trading and monetizing profits more quickly in our portfolios. Why is that important? Well, if you look at just the contours of the last 6 or so months, there's been significant narrative volatility under this regime. So therefore, we think it's more prudent to lock in gains more frequently for 10 to 20 basis point moves instead of staying in the trade longer and trying to hit a home run. To wrap it up, you know, if we look at our portfolios right now, we're currently overweight credit in our short and intermediate strategies. We think that those strategies are, you know, it's important to have a decent amount of risk on here due to attractive carry and roll down opportunities in the front end of the curve. Conversely, as you move out the curve for long credit, we are more neutral in our long duration strategies and we see the risks more balanced. On the positive side, you have attractive all-in yields. You have muted supply from a long-end perspective as corporations are reluctant to issue in the long end of the curve, given that they don't want to pay these higher coupons. But then from a negative side, or one of the reasons that keeps us a little bit cautious there, is the fact that spreads are at the tighter end of the historical spectrum. So from a long credit perspective, we're a little bit more cautious than we are compared to our shorter duration credit strategies.
Okay, thank you, Anthony. Such a comprehensive view of how you're navigating the fixed income landscape. And what I'm hearing in general is you're having to be even more nimble than usual in response to the policy volatility. Well, Chris, Sonia mentioned earlier that there's been a lot of talk in the market and in the commentariat about global investors reconsidering their exposure to dollar assets in light of the backdrop. What approach are you taking within the multi-asset team?
Yeah, so thanks, Max. Really interesting question. I mean, it's almost like people woke up on the 1st of January and realized that US dollar assets were quite a large share of global equities and global bonds. It had never struck them before. How have we been responding to that, the multi-asset team? Well, we've been underweight dollars in our dynamic funds since the start of the year. That speaks to, I think, a consensus that bizarrely has flipped through 180 degrees over the space of 6 months. You would go back to 6 months ago, the consensus was very much that tariffs were coming and tariffs meant the dollar was going to be stronger because of the impact on trade flows. That seemingly turned on its head and became tariffs are coming and that means the dollar is going to be weaker because of the impact on capital flows. Defense number one, kind of been underweight dollars in our dynamic funds, but the more structural defense is we've always taken a more nuanced approach to international diversification that would be consistent with a market cap weighted approach. And that means less dollars than a market cap weighted approach because it means less concentration in US assets. I think there's kind of a bigger picture question here about dollar exposure that Anthony and Sonia have already spoken to. So I don't want to kind of go over that ground again. But I do want to come back to one point that Anthony made on the Federal Reserve. The kind of administration attacks on the Fed are unusual, but they're not totally without precedent. You just have to go back a long way. And interestingly, you have to go back to the last time that US public debt levels were this high. During the war years and the post-war years, the Treasury set monetary policy. The yields on T-bills were capped at 0.375%. The yields on bonds were capped at 2.5%. And it was only in 1951 that the Fed gained operational independence through the Fed Treasury Accord. Now, like, what's the point of this history lesson? The point of this history lesson is that the last time public debt levels were this high, administrations were doing lots of things to try to keep caps on the rate of interest payable on that debt. We haven't got to that stage yet. If we do, then that is seriously bad news for the US dollar.
Okay, super interesting. And I think it's fair to say we all love history lessons here and very long-term perspectives as well. So thank you for that, Chris. A very quick follow-up question to you too before we move on to Rob, which is, are there any realistic alternatives to US treasuries?
So my answer to that is yes and no, which I appreciate is unhelpful. Yes, individually. So the treasury market, you can measure it a bunch of different ways, but if you take the sort of standard nominal treasury index, it's got an amount outstanding of something like $15 trillion, big numbers. But any individual investor can choose to avoid it. The largest asset owners in the world, individual asset owners, are kind of institutions with about $1 to $2 trillion. The thing they can't avoid, though, is exposure to US interest rate risk. So even if you're not invested in treasuries, you're invested in corporates, then you're going to be taking on US interest rate risk with that. If you're a purist and decide you only want to invest in AAA rated sovereigns, good luck. There aren't very many left. Total debt outstanding of the 10 AAA rated sovereigns that are left is only about $4 trillion. So, you know, it's a much smaller pool to be fishing in. So the sort of individually, yes, you can avoid it, but collectively, no. So collectively, and Sonia's already made this point, like collectively, there is a market equilibrating price that will be necessary to make people absorb the debt that has been issued. Now, despite all the kind of angst about out of control US fiscal policy and the angst about what the US administration has been doing, Treasury yields are actually lower today than at the start of the year. Mm. The transmission thus far has been largely through the dollar rather than treasury prices in US dollars.
Okay. So a somewhat calming view there at the end of your comments, and to perhaps paraphrase Mark Twain, reports of the decline of treasuries have been greatly exaggerated too there. Rob, what does all of this mean for asset classes within private markets, and where does the team see the biggest opportunities as well as risks?
Sure. Thanks, Max. So why don't I start with private credit? And maybe the first comment I'll make is it's really important to differentiate between investment grade and sub-investment grade. A lot of private credit that certainly pension funds already have in their portfolios is sub-investment grade. Actually, there is a large investment grade space as well. And that's probably the area that I would particularly call out. And Anthony's already mentioned that spreads are tight, but total yields are relatively generous versus the last 10 years. So that's an area that we're certainly seeing more interest from a wider pool of investors than we have done in the past. And a number of clients are complementing their public IG portfolios with allocations on the private side. So that's one area. On the equity side, we do see a particular tactical case for UK real estate at the moment, very unloved at the global level over the last few years, but valuations have come off a long way. Valuations are off just over 20%. That compares with a little bit less than 20% in the US, and Europe ex UK is much less off, maybe 14-15%. So we think that's a window to get access to quite attractive pricing. On a forward-looking basis, we think expected returns are plausibly in the mid-sevens, well ahead of Europe ex UK and APAC. So we like UK real estate at the moment. In terms of risks, maybe this is more an area to watch, which would be sub-investment grade credit on the private side. The fundamental backdrop has been very benign over the last several years, and that's translated into good earnings growth for the borrowers in the private credit space. But we've talked a lot about the fact that macro uncertainty is high there, and a lot of loans were made prior to the uplift in rates in 2022. So there's quite a wave of refinancing coming through. So I think we're going to see pressure on the revenue side and on the cost side. And that will definitely challenge some borrowers in that space. And we're really going to, frankly, test the quality of underwriting, which has always been claimed to be very high. Well, we're going to find out.
Okay. So a really useful whistle-stop tour there through private markets. And a related question to you, Rob, is, and you touched on, of course, investors allocating to both public and private assets and kind of hybrid strategies, if you like. What role can private market assets play in diversifying and managing exposure to equity risk?
I mean, diversification is one of the classic reasons why people have allocated to private markets. And I think the most important aspect of that is the fundamentals-driven diversification you get. There are different drivers of returns. And if I'll pick on a space, which is real estate, the demand for real estate does not move one for one with the economy. The supply of real estate through the construction cycle does not move one for one with the economy. And the way that combines into setting rents and rental growth, equally, that doesn't correlate one for one with equity earnings. So you get a fundamental diversification there. That would be true of infrastructure as well. In the private credit space, you also often get a fundamentally different pool of borrowers. Some companies do borrow in both the public and the private markets, but actually there's a large amount of difference. So you get diversification in that way as well. The area that we've sort of touched on already is the geographical aspect of this. And the US is dominant in private markets in the same way that it is on the public side, probably accounts for something like 50 to 55% of private market assets. It is, and it's going to remain, the dominant market, but we are seeing a range of investors looking to complement exposure they already have to the US with strategies and allocations in other places. That will be Europe ex-UK, some of the APAC markets, but the UK as well. And one of the things that we're sort of highlighting, it's not a new fact, but it's a fairly profound one. The UK real estate market is the second largest developed market in the world. It is ranked as the most transparent in the world. And after a long period where many multinational investors have rather turned their back on the market, we're seeing quite a resumption of interest, primarily as people look for complements to the US.
Okay. Thank you for that, Rob. We're going now to turn to Dave and stay with that same theme. Dave, it's great to have not just one, but two US voices on the call. So within index and ETF strategies, how are clients looking to address the related challenges of market vol and concentration risk?
Great. Yeah, thanks, Max. You know, it's funny, this has been a topic for years. You think back to the original acronyms, the FANG, the FANMAG, and now we've got the MAG7. You know, US has been too concentrated for 7+ years now. But, you know, what I get to see in my seat is two things that really drive, you know markets and flow is first, it's client inbound inquiries. And we had inquiries on concentration risk again for that kind of 7-year period, a little bit nervous. And then there's action. And the action is when you see things change. And that's what's different about this time is we're seeing clients actually move flow because of the concentration risk concerns. And I think that comes, you know, all the points previously made. It's not just concern about those stocks anymore. There's geopolitical risk on top. And so you start going, okay, maybe I should start taking some money away from, you know, the top 10 stocks in the US and really shift exposures. And the question is, how are clients expressing that? The simplest is just moving to an equal weight strategy. So yeah, S&P 500, the top 10 companies represent nearly 40% of your exposure in that strategy. If you move to equal weight, it magically drops to 2.5%, those top 10 stocks. So that's the simplest way clients are thinking about expressing concerns on concentration risk. And again, it's different this time. We're seeing less inbound. We're seeing inbound inquiries, but followed up by flow, actual movement of assets from some of those core benchmarks. So that's kind of, you know, phase one of thinking about how to remove some of the concentration risk. But really interesting, throughout that period of time, you know, folks will remember smart beta being a popular topic in factor investing and multi-factor investing, and that kind of fizzled out as well because there was this FOMO of missing out on meteoric returns in cap weighted indices. You know, in addition to equal weight, we're seeing a resurgence in interest in more precise factor strategies where you're trying to allocate to, you know, historically compensated for risk factors in diversified ways. So kind of two ways clients are expressing concerns around that concentration risk as of late. And again, we're seeing a large amount of flow move into both the simple and the more complex ways to deal with that that concern. The last thing I'll just say, though, because I always like to create a counterpoint, you know, concentration risk definitions are important. And so what are you actually trying to achieve? Is it, you know, is it more diversified exposure from what perspective? You know, the number of companies that I get access to and the challenge stat that I always bring up is if you look at the pairwise correlation of the top seven stocks of the Mag 7, it's remarkably low. Most people guess, you know, 80%+ and it's less than 50. It's sub 50% pairwise correlation. So they're you're getting diversified exposures through access to them, but again, you are concentrating your exposure in a handful of issuers. But that's the counterpoint that we discuss, and our plan is just to continue to deliver the products that allow clients to express their views on what's coming up.
Thanks, Dave, for walking us through those market dynamics and client preferences in response to what's been going on. And I mean, a lot of acronyms in there. My takeaways are FANGs, Mag 7, and FOMO among some of the others. A quick follow up question for you too, which is what long term investment themes are the team most excited about right now?
This is going to be a contrarian view, you know, as well. But it, you know, the energy transition, it definitely fizzled out in the U.S. a little bit. Part of that being some of the geopolitical or political winds that have you know, hit the country. But seeing a renewed interest from pockets and renewed interest in the if I'm a long term investor and there's going to be a massive change in the way, you know, we access energy, you know, I want to take advantage of that. And so that's one of the ones that I'm most excited about, not just, you know, where there's been consistent demand, but in pockets of the U.S. where folks are trying to think, okay, you know, what's the next phase? So I throw energy transition in the mix. There is something that I'm really excited about to see how that plays out.
Great, thank you. That's actually a great segue to our next condensed and speedy quick fire section where we're going to actually be talking about contrarian views. So we're going to go around the sort of virtual room. And I will ask each one of you for a brief non-consensus view about markets in the second half of the year. Let's start with you, Sonia.
Maybe not quite non-consensus, but it's interesting that post the immediate outperformance of Europe since the beginning of the year, we have now, of course, seen this turn slightly. And there's far more expectations for the US actually doing quite well in the second half. I would probably stick with Europe, simply for the reason, and it's interesting, when you consider what we've talked about here at the call, it's all US related. So we haven't even touched on what has been happening in Europe ever since the situation changed in the US. And it's clear that Europe moves only in crisis. I think the crisis has been pronounced enough for definitely Germany to move, which in turn is a long overdue change in leadership. And I would believe that this is maybe a longer term, not necessarily just second half shift, that will be very supportive for European assets.
Thank you, Sonia. Just as it's great to have US perspectives on the call, it's great to have a Central European perspective too.
I know I'm a bit biased.
And Dave, what's your second contrarian?
Second, I already gave you the good one, the energy transition. Yeah. Consensus, there's going to be a lot of folks, I guess the way I think about consensus is where the assets are flowing to, as opposed to what people are trying to say in the market. So this is going to sound maybe consensus, but it's contrary to where flow's going. But I'm saying a massive resurgence in active on the equity side, interest from clients in the US. I think there's been this passive wave that continues to grow. Over half the assets, you know, now in passively managed strategies in the U.S. But I can see this kind of volatility created an opportunity and a resurgence of active despite that massive mountain of passive activity.
Very interesting, especially coming from an index man.
Bingo, see?
As well. Rob?
So it's a bit of a theme now. I could pick another real estate example here. So in the last 5 years, there has been a huge amount of interest, justified interest, in very sector-specific funds in real estate, be it residential or industrial. I actually think there's going to be a resurgence of interest in diversified funds. The caricature has been benchmark hugging, boring, low returns. I actually think this market is a really quite interesting one to be less constrained around sectors and to be more opportunistic. I think diversified funds have got quite an interesting place in that environment.
Okay, thanks for that, Rob. Chris?
Sonia's picked Europe, and then I'm from the UK, so I'm picking the UK. So I think there's a cottage industry. I think there's a cottage industry on being negative about the UK stock market that spawns acres of column inches. And people don't seem to want to engage with the fact that the FTSE 100 has outperformed the S&P 500 year to date by about 5% and has also outperformed since the start of 2022. The way that this is written about and discussed, you would just believe that's not true. However, it is true. I think it's kind of like well-placed to continue given that structural bearishness that continues to persist. It doesn't mean that, you know, the headlines around relisting are not serious ones that should, like, serious policy challenges for UK to address. But less supply of equities tends to do quite good things for the price.
Okay, thanks for that, Chris. And finally, Anthony.
All right, Max, I'm going to take a timely one. We had the non-farm payrolls release today, came in stronger than expected. I think there is this view that the labor market continues to be very resilient. I'm going to take the opposite side of the view. I think that headline payrolls are overstating the underlying strength in the labor market here, and I do expect to see the labor market weaken somewhat in the next 6 months of the year. And I have a few reasons that I point to. Persistent negative payroll revisions has been a theme here for the last 18 months. We have low hiring rate in the U.S. We also have atypically low turnover. So I think that that points to weakness going forward as well. And because of that view, I am going to be more constructive on duration, particularly in the long end of the U.S. yield curve. And I know that's not a popular one, given the fiscal situation that we all have talked about in the U.S. So that's my non-consensus view.
Okay, thanks for that. And it takes us nicely back to where we started the call, actually, in terms of debt sustainability. Thank you, Anthony. Well, before we start to look to wrap up, Sonia, as we always do, we've covered a lot of ground today. Is there anything you would add, and what do you think the key takeaways for investors are?
Thank you, Max. And you rightly said there were many topics that we have discussed today, and in a way, they're just a reflection of the inflection point that we have been experiencing since the beginning of the year. And when I say inflection point, I not only refer to the geopolitical situation, which I think Anthony alluded to earlier. Some of these trends have been underway for some time, but of course, we have seen a level of acceleration that means the market and us overall have to just deal with the realities of a new global backdrop that will lead to rather unpredictable changes and uncertainty that, when I say uncertainty, will not always lead to worse outcomes, but will lead to changes that investors will need to assess in order to understand how they will influence the overall market backdrop. The inflection point we have had in markets as well, with a shift in interest rates and, of course, the inflationary shock that still persists. And now we will slowly move towards the context of debt sustainability, fiscal sustainability, budget deficits. Again, we have focused a lot on the US today, but of course, what has been happening in the UK over the past couple of days, again, was a timely reminder. Even here, we have seen a strong reaction in gilt yields, i.e. the market being a lot more alert and sensitive to the discussions around the very difficult situation most governments find themselves in, with very little wiggle room and very difficult decisions to take. As such, concentration risk, we've heard a lot today, but it is very clear that investors are taking a step back amidst these inflection points I've just highlighted to understand whether the kind of overall risk exposure that they have, and that, you know, is regionally, it is asset class, it is currency, and to understand whether in the global context this is still commensurate with their risk appetite. And as I said right at the beginning, this will not lead to immediate selling pressure because, as we've heard today on the call, there's not necessarily any immediate alternative that would come to mind that could just absorb any flows that would come out of dollar-denominated assets. But as I said, not buying into more, i.e. having a buyer strike for going forward, would probably be a significant shift. And I think there's clearly willingness to think about diversification at a more granular level, to say, okay, if I don't have an immediate one-to-one swap, I will look at different alternatives to see where I can find the right risk-return profile. That is a profound shift. And as I said earlier, I think equally important is the understanding how the world will engage with the way the US is engaging with the world, and whether the trust in US institutions can be upheld, because that at the end of the day is what drives trust, and capital markets depend on trust to function. That's far longer term. This is not what will unfold in 2025. But given the inflection points, and I wouldn't underestimate how significant they are, there is a real opportunity to take a step back and assess. And there will be opportunities to engage in a way with the market because, of course, all change will create lots of opportunities as well.
100%. Thank you for that, Sonia. And of course, we will return to these themes and look at how those dynamics play out in future editions of this podcast and future outlooks too. Well, before we all disappear, some of us to the July 4th celebrations, I would just ask you all what you are planning on watching, reading, or listening to over the summer. I will get started and say I'm going to complete watching The Last of Us zombie show, and it's great. But also, I wouldn't recommend watching it just before you go to sleep at night, because it can trigger quite disturbing dreams. A hot tip from me, Sonia.
Clearly a hot tip, but yeah, Definitely not one for me. A bit more lighthearted. It's the 3rd of July. We're in the first week of Wimbledon. And so, of course, it's strawberries and cream time and watching a bit of tennis.
Fantastic. Chris?
I'm going to take issue with The Last of Us being a zombie show. It's really a social critique. However, the two things, I've just bought two books. The New Leviathans by John Gray. It's about the kind of role of the nation state in this post-liberal age. I'm only about 5 pages in, but the first 5 pages are great. And then following that, it's going to sound a bit weird in this context, a book called Team of Rivals, which is about Lincoln and his gathering together of a group of not like-minded individuals to make the collective stronger than the individuals and the US Civil War.
Okay, thank you for that, Chris. Rob?
I'm going to go to TV. So we are about halfway through a Danish drama called Families Like Ours, which is a really thought-provoking, I think you could view it as a scenario on climate change and how that might play out. I have to be honest, it's not exactly uplifting, though. So the other thing we're going to be watching, the Great British Sewing Bee is back next week. So we will watch that again.
Yeah, thank you for that. Rob, Dave?
Yeah, I may be the only one watching this, but the FIFA Club World Cup has been on the television over the summer, but it's been some good drama. And then I'll throw the CONCACAF Gold Cup on top of that. I'm a soccer/football fan, as you can imagine. So, you know, the U.S. has got a really hard qualifying, for the World Cup, given all the island nations out here are super strong. I say that in jest, of course. But yeah, FIFA Club World Cup has been taking up my time.
Great. Thank you. And finally, Anthony.
I'm a big basketball fan, and the NBA season is just finished, so it's going to be slow for me. I do find myself watching Miss Rachel or Mika, which is what my 2 and 4-year-old daughters watch. They tend to dominate the remote control in the Woodside household, unfortunately. But if I do get some time, I do have a plan to finally start watching Game of Thrones, only around a decade later than everyone else. So that's the plan.
Hey. It's great. There's quite a few zombies in that too. I just warn you, Greg. We've got tennis, Lincoln. We've got Rob. I've completely forgotten.
British showing bit.
So
very highbrow.
Of course, football/soccer, and children's TV and the Game of Thrones. So lots there for our clients and listeners to get their ears, eyes into over the summer. That's a great point on which to end today's call. Thank you, Sonia, Dave, Anthony, Chris, and Rob. And thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. You'll be able to find our Mid-Year Global Outlook on the LNG website today and see our other updates on our social media channels, our blog, and of course, here on our podcast.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of LNG's asset management division as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against LNG in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information. Not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to LNG, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.